Humans are social creatures. We mimic each other. Ideas, behaviors, and emotions spread throughout your social network. And so it's the most obvious thing to me that a 5,000% increase in teenage girls identifying as transgender that coincides precisely with the moment that the modern trans rights movement began.
Hey, Joyful Warriors, Tiffany Justice here with Moms for Liberty, and we have two Joyful Warriors joining us today, two parents. I'm very excited to invite and to have on today Mia Hughes and one of our favorite guys across the United States and Canada, Chris Elston, also known as Billboard Chris. Welcome to the Joyful Warrior podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Always a pleasure. I'm excited to have this chat today.
Absolutely. So for those of you that you may know Chris because he's been on the podcast before, and I know he's traveled around to many Moms for Liberty chapters across the United States and many different events, really explaining and helping us to understand this thing called gender ideology that seems to have crept into every crack and crevice of our children's lives. And then reminding us that no child is ever born in the wrong body and children are perfect just the way they are. And so we love Chris so much. But Mia is someone that I'm just meeting, but I've heard a lot about. And so Mia, how does a mom, a stay-at-home mom, three kids, end up being able to release these internal documents from something called WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health? Tell me a little bit about you and your background that's brought us to this moment.
My story is something of an interesting one. I was a stay-at-home mother for 9 years with my three children. And then, you know, I put them into school. They made it back. They were all in school, and I made it back into the workforce for about 18 months, and then COVID hit. And my children did about a day and a half of remote learning, and that was when I realized that this was definitely not for us, was not for our family. So I pulled them out, and I homeschooled all three of them all the way through COVID. And it was... Well, shortly before COVID hit was when I had discovered the gender issue. So prior to that, as a lifelong left-leaning voter, I was a little bit woke. I was, it's embarrassing, but I was perhaps a little bit woke. I was going along with trans women and women and stuff like that, not because I believed it, but just because I thought it was the kind thing to do. And then in December 2019, J.K. Rowling tweeted her famous tweet in support of Maya Forstater. Maya was a tax consultant who had been fired, lost her job, basically for saying men are not women. And so J.K. tweeted in support of Maya, and the tweet was gorgeously worded and perfectly reasonable. And I read it and I thought, I completely agree with all of this. And then I saw people just losing their minds, calling her a TERF, the vicious, the vitriolic outpouring of hate that she endured made no sense to me because this was a great tweet. And so I actually asked woke friends, and they were really upset with her calling her transphobic and calling her a TERF.
Okay, so what's a TERF? Remind us what a TERF is for all those moms out there that might not know.
The official, the acronym stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. I would say that most women who are called TERFs, anyone who says women are female, men are not women, and children can never be born in the wrong body, they will get the label TERF. Anyone who lives in reality and dares to say so will be called a TERF. So they were calling her a TERF. And I realized I agreed with her, which also made me a TERF. And it was on that day, I recall the very day, that was the day that I was reading the Twitter threads that were going on this tweet. And I realized that we were supposed to believe that trans women were literally women. I didn't know we were supposed to actually believe that. I thought we were just going along with it, pretending that they were women to be kind to them. And then I discovered the concept of the male lesbian that same day, the utterly absurd concept of a male lesbian, men who think they're lesbians. And shortly after that was when I learned that children are being told that they can be born in the wrong body, and that adolescents were having their puberty blocked, were being pumped full of cross-sex hormones that were irreversible, and were having healthy body parts amputated. And from that moment on, my life changed completely. I started speaking about it, which eventually led to a full-time job working for the Post-Millennial covering gender. And then I ended up with Michael Schellenberger. As almost as soon as I started writing for Michael Schellenberger, we got the WPATH files, which is what I just wrote a report about. It's internal communications from from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, which is the, I turned it into a 70-page think tank report that has just been released.
So what a journey from being a stay-at-home mom, going through all the same stuff we are all going through during COVID, right? To really being on in this, releasing this groundbreaking report, showing us these internal conversations that were happening. And so Mia, tell us a little bit about those files. What were some of those internal conversations like?
Sure. So a bit of background about the files. So this is WPATH. Anyone can join WPATH. This is a supposedly a professional association advocating for transgender health, and anyone can join. You just pay a fee and you join. So it's this weird hybrid organization where there are doctors, surgeons, endocrinologists, therapists, and then just trans activists, human rights lawyers, people who are transgender and have an interest in gender medicine. And it's this weird mix of people inside this group. And everyone who is a member gets access to this forum where supposedly people are supposed to, healthcare professionals are supposed to talk about cases, share science, improve patient outcomes, all the rest of it. And that's not what's happening in WPATH. So what we got were, and they came in a number of batches. I don't know who the source is or the sources are. Only Michael knows, but we got a large batch to start off with. And it was very broad range. It's all of these conversations where WPATH members will show up in the forum and someone's got a really difficult case and they don't know what to do with this particular patient. And so they will ask the forum a question. They'll describe the case and say, what should I do? I don't know what to do about this. And then a chorus of people come along encouraging medicalization, engaged in political activism, and always encouraging medicalization. So a specific example would be, there's a therapist who shows up who says, I've got this patient. They don't call them patients, they call them clients. That's a key to what's going on in there. I've got this patient who has major depressive disorder, schizoaffective traits, all of these terrible mental health problems, and he wants vaginoplasty. He wants to have the surgery. And they're like, I'm not really sure if he's going to be able to cope. Well, be able to cope with the post-op care, which is very, very arduous. It's very difficult. What should I do? I'm perplexed. And then a whole bunch of people come along saying, oh, you know, why? I don't see why you are perplexed, and mental illness is not a reason not to let this person consent. And someone else comes along and says, in 15 years, I've only ever turned down one person, and that's because they were in active psychosis in the assessment and they were hallucinating and everybody else got their surgical referral. And so it's just a whole bunch of people come along and there's no caution. There's nobody questioning, should we be medicalizing this person? Is this person capable of consenting? It's just everyone comes along encouraging the medical pathway every time.
Well, we've seen evidence of this across Europe, now in Canada, in America. So it's not surprising in a lot of ways to many of us across the world, right? But still shocking to see the interactions. And thank you for taking the time to dig through all of that to help to write this report. So you now work, you said, with Michael Schellenberger. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Michael and environmental progress and the work that you do?
So environmental progress, Michael, first of all, started out as an environmentalist. I don't know if I'm going to get this right, actually. I'll do my best to get this accurate. He was an environmentalist. And because he was pro-nuclear, that's wrong think, or it certainly was at the time in the environmentalist world. And so he got ousted by the sort of pro-green energy environmentalist group. And he wrote, first of all, he wrote a book, Apocalypse Never. It's a great book. And he has this think tank, Environmental Progress, which was started around this time. Then he wrote about homelessness, because again, there's the way homelessness is dealt with by certain people on the left, it's compassion, but it's gone way too far to the point that it's harming people. And I think there's a really strong parallel with what's going on in the gender issue. It's also compassion, but very misguided compassion that ends up being very harmful. And so those were his two issues. And then when he discovered gender, he saw the parallels very, very clearly. And he has a good heart, right? So he just saw that something terrible was happening to a very vulnerable group of people, and he wanted to do something about it. And so we worked together on this project.
So speaking of someone with a very good heart, we'll bring you into the conversation, Chris Elston, another guy, right? A man, right? But all of the things that Mia is saying, all of the things that, that Michael has seen, this weaponized compassion being used against us, right? It's the way they try to force a lot of this stuff on our kids, Chris, whether it's gender or other stuff in our schools. What was your first thought? I want to know how you and Mia met, but I want to stay on the files for a second. What was your first thought when you saw the WPATH files breaking and Mia's report come out?
I knew these were coming, and honestly, none of this surprises me. It's great to have more of this evidence. We've had a lot of similar evidence, more disjointed, but this is fantastic the way it's all been compiled, and the report that Mia has done, I think, will be very helpful going forward with legislators in lawsuits, because there's a lot of evidence here that can be used in all of these court cases that are coming, both civilly representing these detransitioners, and when it comes to court cases like the ACLU, which is suing all of these different states that have passed legislation to stop this child abuse. There's tons of evidence. And we also have court cases that are going to end up at the Supreme Court. So it's fantastic. And I think it's just amazing, considering I met Mia just over 3 years ago. It was March 11th, 2021. And I had taken a trip to Ottawa just to do my thing. This was before the borders were opened, so I couldn't go south of the border. And I'd been to Ottawa many times. That was probably my third or fourth trip. I've been there probably 9 or 10 times now. But back then, I'd only been doing what I do for 6 or 7 months, and it was very difficult to get anyone to come out on the street with me. And this woman from Twitter reached out and said she'd like to come have conversations with me, which I thought was fantastic, especially because she kind of, back then, it was a lot of the feminists talking about this, and the feminists had been attacking me and telling all these sorts of lies about me. And so she was very brave to do it, not only because this was a controversial topic to talk about, but because I think a lot of people in that group said, "What are you doing standing with him?" And she stood up for me, which I really respect. And she talked to me in person and found out I wasn't this scary man. So anyway, we had these great conversations on the street. And I still remember the first conversation we had. There was a woman probably 55, 60 years old who stopped us on the street corner. And she naturally started to talk to Mia, because oftentimes this is how it goes. Women will talk to the woman who's with me. And I realized right away, my gosh, she is so brilliant. I don't have to say a thing. I can just sit back and relax and let her take control of this whole conversation. And to this day, she's still the smartest person I've ever been out on the street with, and probably the best partner in thought crime that I've done this with. So that was great. She then put a curse on me whereby I would get attacked the day after we hang out. This has happened many times. The next day I was in...
Not intentional, I might say.
Unintentional, but it's still a curse. And the next day I was in Montreal and I got my arm broken.
Yeah. Is that the famous video with the mustard?
Yes, I got squirted with mustard and jumped by six people. And that was great because it helped elevate this conversation some more. And, you know, back then, I think Mia was a little more tentative to be public with all of this because, you know, it's new and her social circles will perhaps look down upon her or say, what the heck are you doing? So I think it's just fabulous to fast forward 3 years and she's now the face of the WPATH files, one of the most important projects that has happened in taking down this cult of gender.
So you talk about the cult of gender. Chris had shared with me, Mia, that you had done a lot of research about social contagion and the social contagion aspect of this gender issue that I call it gender madness that we deal with. And so I'd love to go back a little bit. So we've talked a little bit about the most breaking news, the WPATH files, you releasing those, really showing internal conversations happening within WPATH, this professional organization, as you said, can't be a medical source, you know, organization, not everyone's a doctor, but so it's, you're right, it's a very interesting conglomeration of people coming together and having these conversations. But in America, I think for a lot of people, the social contagion piece has been something that I think people are really waking up to, right? The very large percentages of kids identifying as, you know, trans or non-binary or what, you know, any of the other myriad of things, right? So I'd love to zero in on that because I think that's something that a lot of our moms have been very focused on. A lot of parents, right? They understand this social contagion part is very catching. And when the kids get pulled in on the social part, it tends to be a pathway to a lot of the rest of these different medical transition issues. So can you talk a little bit about some of your research around social contagion?
Sure. The social contagion element is crucial. And it blows my mind that there are still people out there who deny that we have a social contagion of gender dysphoria, because you know, you only need to take a cursory glance at history and you can see the exact same thing has happened over and over and over again. We've had social contagions of eating disorders. I mean, bulimia is the one that I've written about before, where In 1980, bulimia became an eating disorder. It was included in the DSM, the American Psychiatric Association's Bible, basically, of diagnoses. And within a few years, I think about 30 million people had bulimia, because once you name and describe a condition, a psychiatric condition like this, you actually create the means by which it spreads. People can then talk about bulimia. They were talking about it in magazines, on talk shows. Bulimia was suddenly in the lexicon and everyone's talking about it. And that planted the idea into the vulnerable minds of teenage girls and young women that you could binge and purge. It would never have occurred to most women had they not come across it in these magazines and on these talk shows. The exact same thing happened in Hong Kong with anorexia. In 1994, a schoolgirl collapsed and died on a busy Hong Kong street, a terrible tragedy. And it turned out that she had died. She had starved herself to death. She had the Western version of anorexia. The media frenzy that occurred as a result of that, it was all over the newspapers, as well as, ironically, they did sort of like educational programs in schools to try to avert another such tragedy, planted the idea into the minds of teenage girls and young women in Hong Kong that anorexia was a thing and you could, you know, starve yourself and be very thin. And it triggered a contagion of anorexia. There's too many to even list. We've had social contagions of cutting. We've had social contagions of there's even like phenomenon the TikTok tick. You know, like the kids are watching people TikTok celebrities with Tourette's, and then they mimic the behavior. Humans are social creatures. We mimic each other. Ideas, behaviors, and emotions spread throughout your social network, and so it's the most obvious thing to me that a 5,000% increase in teenage girls identifying as transgender that coincides precisely with the moment that the modern trans rights movement began. And this is not your average rights movement. This was a rights movement that all the groundwork was done behind the scenes. They laid all the groundwork and then they just thrust it upon us. And so all of a sudden, around the early to mid 2010s, we were bombarded with messages about gender identities. All of a sudden, what makes you a boy, girl, man, or woman is a gender identity, not the material reality of your body. This messaging showed up in school curricula. This messaging was all over social media. And the girls and the teenage girls, the young women, and some very vulnerable boys as well, and vulnerable men, that imbibed that narrative, that thought got planted into their mind, the idea that they could have a mismatched gender identity, because this rights movement is relentlessly telling them if they're unhappy with any part of their body, or they don't fit in, or they're struggling, that could be a sign that they're transgender. Of course, they're latching on to that idea. And the most dangerous part of it is it comes with a ready-made solution, a remedy. If you transition, if you look at all the TikTok and the YouTube trans influencers, they make it out as if medical transition is the miracle cure. If you take the testosterone, if you have the mastectomy, you will be happy and life will be rainbows and unicorns. And so very, very vulnerable people are getting sucked into something that it's not their fault. It's the cultural madness that is surrounding them. And then they're being offered the tantalizing promise that all of their problems will be resolved if they take this medical pathway. And then you throw into that the fact that the medical world has lost its mind. The medical world has lost its ethical compass and is just transitioning all of these young people swept up in this mad cultural moment.
Chris, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Not really. I told you she was brilliant. Yeah, that perfectly sums this all up. And it's not just the medical organizations which have been really taken over by activists, it's our courts. And so parents who do object to this, parents who are still rooted in reality, who know that their girl is not a boy and does not need testosterone to be her true self, well, they're losing their rights, not only with these doctors who disagree with them, with judges in the court system do not support them, and then legislatively, all of these leftist parties are also captured by this ideology, and they're passing legislation to take away your parental rights. CPS will consider it abuse if you're not affirming the delusion of your child. And some parents are losing their children because they're actually wanting to protect their children. We just saw Illinois trying to pass a bill where it would be considered abuse not to affirm your child's magical gender identity. Fortunately, that didn't get out of committee. But they're trying in all of these blue states. Up here in Canada, it's the same thing. In British Columbia, in Ontario, in Quebec, parental consent is not needed at any age for these children. A father went to jail last year because he was powerless to stop his 13-year-old daughter from going on testosterone. He spoke out about it. He was given a gag order not to speak out about it by the judge, and he kept speaking out about it anyway. And so for violating the gag order, he went to jail. So this is just a total mad society we live in. All of the so-called human rights organizations like the ACLU, the Human Rights Campaign, etc., they are all captured by this as well. We have a whistleblower from Missouri named Jamie Reed, who describes herself as a queer woman married to a trans man, politically left of Bernie Sanders. She blew the whistle on this last year. And the ACLU is now subpoenaing all the organizations she talked to, because how dare she blow the whistle? They are the American Civil Liberties Union, upset that she exerted her civil liberties.
Yes, many of the institutions in America are very captured. I think it's important that you bring up the court system, and I'd like to talk about some of the different legal things that are happening right now around this issue of parental rights and gender ideology. You know, I don't call it affirming care. Nothing about it is affirming or affirmative for children. But I think during COVID, you know, you talk, Mia, about, you know, bringing your kids and homeschooling them and protecting them during that time. I think Americans saw that we have a lot of captured institutions, that the education system, it doesn't really matter where you live, red state, blue state, captured institution. You know, when you have schools that are messaging to children, you could be born in any, you know, you could have been born in the wrong body, or let's have private conversations behind closed doors, which is happening, right? And Chris, I want to talk about that with you. But we really learned that a lot of our court systems have become captured, a lot of our courtrooms, a lot of the judges. And so we're in this cycle, I think, where parents and Americans in general are saying, well, this is really bad, but of course they're not going to do it in my kid's school, or that's not going to happen at my kid's doctor's office. Or when it gets to the court system, well, of course the court isn't going to say that this is okay, because it's just common sense. Parents have the right to direct the upbringing of their kids. And then we're kind of like, oh, wait, no. You know, now we've got, Chris, courts around the United States. I know one in the 11th Circuit, January Littlejohn in Leon County, another one, Ludlow versus Foote, and that's in Massachusetts, I believe, where there was secret transition, social transition happening in a school with a child behind the backs of the parents. This is 6 pages of forms being filled out between a child and adults at the school. What name do you want to use? What at school? What name should we use with your parents? What pronouns would you like to use? What bathroom would you like to use? Who would you like to sleep with when you go on overnight field trips? What a betrayal of trust. But Chris, when it got to the court said, doesn't shock the conscience of the court that this is happening.
It's incredible, isn't it? And that's another institution I left out, all these educational institutions led by all of these teachers' unions, which are all run by literal communists, because over the past several decades, these leftist organizations, which originally might have just been more concerned with workers' rights and things like that, they've all been dominated by the most radical among them. And so the more moderate people from the traditional left, people like where Mia has come from or Michael Schellenberger, they have no voice in these political parties anymore, because if they dare to say anything, they're decried as a bigot and canceled. So we have a major problem throughout the West. Just yesterday, for example, in Canada, this is hilarious. I mean, it's very sad. But a Supreme Court judge said that it was problematic to refer to a woman in a sexual assault case as a woman. And she then referred to her as a person with a vagina. And it's important to note, no one involved in this sexual assault case was transgender. This case had nothing to do with transgenderism, but our Supreme Court justice is now saying it's problematic to refer to females as women.
Mia, what is going on? I mean, honestly, how insulting. I mean, listen, first of all, I want to go back to the social contagion part and talk about this for a moment. As a woman in general, I've been a girl. I've grown up to be a woman. I've raised a girl who's grown up to be a woman. I've met a lot of women and girls. I have yet to meet the woman who is like, puberty is so fantastic. I loved every single minute. When I got breasts and I started having my period, it was so fun and I loved every second. Anyone?
Absolutely no way. I mean, that's the crazy thing about this is the first generation of teenage girls who have been given the option of opting out of puberty. And they are doing so in droves. We've given them a reason to opt out of puberty. And yet so many people, for some reason, think that this is cause for celebration, that all of these young women, they don't want to be men, let's face it. They don't think they're boys. They don't want to be boys. They just don't want to be girls. They just don't want to develop. They just don't want to go through female puberty. And we, in our madness, allow that. We as a society have allowed them all to opt out of puberty instead of just telling them it gets better. It is a horrible time in your life. I personally as well have never met anyone who enjoyed it. It's just awful, but it gets better and you settle in and you come to love being female. And we're stealing that from them. We're robbing them of that chance. It's a true crime.
I think we're stealing the kids from a lot of joy from the kids. I mean, just the joy of, you know, we look at the hypersexualization of kids in schools, right? And stealing the joy of sex and of, you know, discovery and all of that. We're just taking all of that from them. So this court in Canada saying women are vagina bear. What did they say? Women, people who have vaginas. Is that what they said?
Yeah, individuals, people with a vagina.
And wasn't it a woman who said that? The judge was a woman, wasn't she?
Yeah. This is the thing. It's mostly white, progressive, regressive women pushing this.
So,
and yeah. I used to get in trouble for saying that, but I think everyone understands this is true now. It's preying on the natural empathy and agreeableness of women, which is one of their big five personality traits. They're more agreeable and they don't, you know, like to rock the boat with the group as much. But I think I want to just go off on a separate tangent for just a moment, if I can, because when I first started doing all my research into this back in 2019 and then throughout 2020, I think I felt like a lot of people feel there must be something to gender ideology. What is this all about? And I kept reading and reading and reading and reading. And I came to the conclusion, every single aspect of this is based on lies. There's no truth to this whatsoever. I have this expression that we have two sexes, zero genders, and infinite personalities, because that just sums us all up beautifully. But in these WPATH files, in the introduction to it, Mia does a fabulous job going through the history of how this started. And I think it would be really valuable for people to learn about this, because it gives you this light bulb moment where you understand how this started as this seed of lies and how it's grown into what it is. And when we understand that, I think it helps give us clarity about how this whole thing is nonsense. And just understanding the source of something helps us to be able to diagnose what's going on and to fight it.
Go ahead, Mia, give us a little intro, give us a sneak peek, and then we'll make sure we direct everyone to the full, to your full reporting.
You want me to go I'll go as fast as I can. So, I mean, we're talking but back to the social contagion thing just for a second, is that what we're dealing with is it's a culture-bound syndrome. It's a culture-bound psychiatric epidemic. And that means it's exploded into our culture at this place and at this time. But there have probably always been a tiny, tiny number of people who have felt, for whatever reason, that they would rather be a member of the opposite sex. And so, but it had to evolve with medical technology. So in the sort of early 20th century, we've got very dubious experiments going on, surgical experiments, attempts at sex changes, and it's all very dubious. And then it kind of just interest goes away. Well, there's a war, and then, you know, the interest wanes, to be rejuvenated in the 1950s by the famous case of Christine Jorgensen, who arrives back from Denmark, and it's this blonde beauty. It's a man who has undergone surgery to become a woman. The interesting thing about him is he was gay and very, very homophobic and did not want to be in a gay relationship. So transitioned to be something like a woman and therefore was more comfortable with his sexuality. But then, so in the early days, WPATH forms in 1978. It's all very dubious, but at least in the early days, in my mind, they were attempting something like a scientific quest to find the best medical way to help people with this very difficult psychiatric condition. But then around the late 1990s, turn of the century, they take a sharp turn. Well, they take a turn for the political. They take a turn for the ideological. And that is quite simply because more and more activists joined a group. And this is also, at the same time, the beginning of the modern trans rights movement. The political side is happening on one end, and the medical side is happening over here. And the two are colliding. The two collide. More and more activists join the group. And then in 2007, and I'm calling them WPATH. They were actually called, let me see if I can get this right, the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association, HBICDA. In 2007, they reinvent themselves. They go for a rebrand and they call themselves the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. And this is a big move because they self-identify as world, as a global organization, a professional organization, and for transgender health. This is when they take a really sharp turn for the ideological. This is when we get affirmation, the affirmative model of care. All of a sudden, gender, at the time the diagnosis was gender identity disorder. People within WPATH, the political activists within WPATH, don't like this at all because that means being transgender is a pathology. It's stigmatizing. So based on no science whatsoever, they've not got any new evidence, they decide that they want the diagnosis changed to gender dysphoria. Therefore, you're taking away the gender identity now is not the problem. That's perfectly natural and healthy that a person could have a gender identity that doesn't even exist, that doesn't match their body. The pathology now becomes the discomfort that you feel because your gender identity does not match the body. And then it was a stroke of genius, really. It was brilliant because then the treatment is not aiming to reconcile the body with this supposed gender identity. It's not trying to help the person overcome their mismatch. It's medicalization to bring the body and the mind in line, bring the body in line with the gender identity. That will ease the dysphoria. That's the remedy for the dysphoria. So from that point on, we're off in this other direction where you can't do anything about the gender identity. All you can do is medicalize the body with hormones and surgeries. And as the years went on, they became more and more militant. It became a human right to have access to hormones and surgeries, even for adolescents, even for very vulnerable adults. Denying that right then became bigotry and transphobia. And the culture within WPATH is such now that it's simply nobody within there would ever suggest psychotherapy to help a person reconcile with their body. It's all the medical pathway in the other direction.
Thank you for that explanation. That's excellent. You know, one of the questions I remember with speaking with Chris early on is, you know, it feels like you would parent this issue like you would any other issue that you would parent, you know, in your home with your child, any other type of mental distress. You might think about anorexia. If my daughter, you know, thought she was fat and she wanted to starve herself, if I helped her or got her lap band surgery or encouraged this, then I would be held criminally liable. But in this situation, it's like upside down world, right, for parents. And so one of the things that we've really focused on at Moms for Liberty, and Chris has been so incredibly helpful, is really informing parents, giving them the best information. Because if all you're hearing from so many different medical associations, and in America, we're hearing, you know, affirm, 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 right, that this is what medically is necessary or important. And so I want to get into that for a second with both of you, because I think if parents had the truth, parents really knew that puberty blockers are not reversible and that they're, you know, causing long-term harms for their children that they can never take back, that they would be much more cautious in the decisions that they made. So I went on Dr. Phil twice, but once about parental rights and around this issue of gender ideology. And you're allowed to ask him one question. And the question that I asked him at that time that I went on was, Dr. Phil, are you aware at the very high incidence of children with autism also being diagnosed with having gender dysphoria? Are you concerned about that? Of course, he didn't answer the question, and you know, we moved on to something else. But that was one of the things that was a real red flag for me when hearing about Tavistock and the closing of Tavistock and the high incidence in girls of moderate to severe autism. And so, Chris, you know, we just got some amazing news out of England recently that they are no longer going to be allowing puberty blockers to be prescribed for children. And that's amazing news and such progress in England in such a short period of time, it seems. Where's America with all of this? And I do want you both to talk about just the incredible vulnerabilities of kids and this I want to debunk the suicide lie, Chris. I want to make sure that we really hit on some of the different studies that you've shared with me that show that, you know, this idea of do you want a live son or a dead daughter is total baloney.
It's total baloney. And we have two great studies that have just come out in the last week. One was conducted in 2021 from California, but I don't think anyone knew about it. And this great reporter from the New York Post just released it. So in California, they followed over 800 men who had undergone sex reassignment surgery. So they had, you know, castration and vaginoplasty. And there was more than 300 women who had undergone these surgeries, which is totally gruesome. They'll tend to cut off their forearm or some of their inner thigh to create what they call this neophallus. And it's just very gruesome and terrible. But anyway, they followed these many cases. They looked at the data from 2 years before and 2 years after their surgeries. And in the 2 years preceding with the men, there had been 1.5% of them who had attempted suicide. In the 2 years following, 3.3% of them attempted suicide. So the actual attempted suicides more than doubled. We're told all the time that kids will kill themselves if we don't transition them. My gosh, what? You're saying if we don't cut off the body parts of a child, they're going to kill themselves? Do you hear yourself right now? It's crazy talk. But this is effective by these leftists who push this because obviously nobody wants children to die. And when you have parents sitting in a gender clinic office with their vulnerable child who is probably experiencing 5 other mental health comorbidities, because on average, these children who undergo transition have 5 or more co-occurring mental health issues. Autism is prevalent in, I would say, more than half of these cases. We know from the Tavistock, out of a sample of more than 1,000 children, 35% had moderate to severe autism, never mind the mild cases. And when I talk to parents, and I've talked to a lot, it's autism, 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 autism. A ton of these kids have suffered sexual abuse. It's extremely common. Dr. Quentin Van Meter from the American College of Pediatricians, the good College of Pediatricians, not the American Academy, he estimates probably 60% of these kids have had sexual abuse, and he works with them as a professional. But a ton of these kids are in state care. A lot of them have eating disorders. There's been bullying. There's been terrible home lives. There's other psychiatric disorders. And so it's the most vulnerable youth who are being harmed in these gender clinics. And we have data from Tavistock, which showed that from 2010 to 2020, there were 4 suicides. Now, their waiting list, keep in mind, is 15,000 children. They get about 500 referrals per month. And in that 10-year span, 2 kids who were on the waiting list committed suicide, 2 kids who were being treated committed suicide. As a percentage, this breaks down to 0.0 something. It's very small. There's no epidemic of suicides going on. Laura Edwards-Leeper, who started the first gender clinic in Boston in 2007 and was transitioning kids for 15 years, wrote in the Washington Post, she's not aware of any epidemic of suicides. It's just a total lie. But we never had solid data. And out of Finland, just in the last week or two, they did a study on these kids. They looked at every child who would come into these gender clinics. And unlike in the United States, where all these children are lost to follow-up, that doesn't happen in Finland unless they move out of the country. So they looked at data going back 20-odd years, more than 2,000 children who had come into the gender clinic, and they compared them to a control group of more than 16,000 kids. And they found that the suicide rate was the same with the kids going to the gender clinic, with kids in the control group, based on their other underlying mental health issues. So it was 0.3% over that time span had committed suicide in the gender clinic group, compared to 0.1% in the general population. But when you compare children with autism in the gender clinic group to autism outside, for example, it's the same. It's not gender that's the issue. It's these other mental health problems that are the issue, obviously. But even then, the percentage is still relatively low. And of course, every suicide is a disaster. I think there were 7 in that entire study over the course of the trial. But to talk to these trans activists, you think that everyone's committing suicide if we don't transition them. Even anecdotally, when I'm out on the street, trans identified people come up to me all the time. And every single one, honestly, will say, if transition hadn't been available to me, I would have killed myself. Really? Well, the data doesn't bear this out. So it's important to keep this in mind when you listen to these surveys and you listen to people talking like this. It doesn't reflect reality because suicides are still very rare, but this is a very successful tactic by the left to silence people and to coerce parents into going along with this.
I'd also add there's a really dark reason why they push, why they need the transition or suicide narrative. And that is because they are advocating for a medical pathway that is as extreme as cancer treatment. There is no other branch of pediatrics that would sterilize a child. And so they need these kids to be suicidal because that's the only medical justification they have for the treatment protocol that they are pushing, that they are advocating for. And so when you see trans activists, like the study that came out of Finland, that's really good news. We just discovered that there is not this massive suicide risk and that they are not, there's no epidemic. Everyone should celebrate that. But the trans activists tried to discredit it and were trashing it because they need these kids to be suicidal because that is the only way they can justify what is being done to them.
That's a really great point. And it really does drive that point home to think about that. And then you think about all of these other issues that the kids are dealing with that they actually don't get the help with that they need, that continues to, you know, be mental struggle for them. And you know, offer this snake oil solution. It's really concerning. Parents need to, you know, really be aware of that. So always questioning and asking questions. Chris, I'd like to discuss with you some of the different legal cases that are happening around the United States. I've touched on two that were transition cases that are happening. We're really fighting hard in the area of parental rights. It's a huge concern that there are adults encouraging our children to keep secrets from their parents. That is groomer behavior. Scott Pelley, 60 Minutes, everybody cannot like that I say it. That's really tough. Predators are the people that tell children to keep secrets from their parents. But there are other cases, Chris, and there are new legal people that have come on the scene. And so if you could just kind of give us an overview of some of the different things that are happening from a legal perspective, and then maybe some policy stuff too, if you'd like to throw that in.
Sure. So Harmeet Dhillon was the first lawyer to take on a couple of these cases. She, of course, is this great lawyer based out of San Francisco. She had previously run for the chair of the RNC. But she took on the case of Chloe Cole, who most of us know. She has been traveling across the United States testifying in all of these state legislatures to help legislation pass stopping this abuse. But when Chloe was 13 at Kaiser Permanente in Oakland, California, she was given puberty blockers and testosterone. She then had a double mastectomy when she was 15 years old and regretted it almost immediately. And then about a year later, officially declared that she was detransitioning. So again, this is another case of a child on the autism spectrum. She suffered a sexual assault, which made her think that she now needed to get her breasts cut off because even though she was identifying as a boy at the time, it still wasn't protecting her from a sexual assault. And this is the thought process for a lot of girls. And then Harmeet is also representing another girl who was 13 years old and 1 month at the same Kaiser Permanente in Oakland, California, when they gave her a double mastectomy. She also has other comorbid factors going on. So this is just unbelievable. People for the longest time didn't believe me when I talked about these things, but we have not only lawsuits to prove it now, we have independent data. We know that children as young as 12 years old have had their breasts cut off in California. Kellen Lackhart, who's a woman identifying as a man at that clinic, has admitted on video to it. She also admits that they have done vaginoplasties on 16-year-old boys, having started the process when they were 50. And when I say start the process, I assume she's referring to hair removal, which has to be done 6 months to a year in advance. But then we had those couple cases. We have one up in Canada. And now, great news, just last year, a new law firm started in Texas. It's called Campbell Miller Payne. These are four dads. One is a former Super Bowl champ from the Pittsburgh Steelers. And they all left their former law firms to start one to represent these detransitioners. Because, you know, they can make money in a lot of ways. There's 100 different ways lawyers can make money. They don't have to take on this, which is much more difficult than other ways they can make a fortune. But they came into this because it's a calling for them. They have 17 children between them. And they learned all about this. And so now they're taking on a lot of cases. And just this last week, they took on one, a case of a suicide. So I guess they're representing the family. But I think in motion right now, there are 11 or 12 cases already started in the US. I'm told there are about 6 more in the works and many more coming. So those are just the civil cases representing these children. There are cases going on in many different states where states have banned this. Alabama banned this. They were one of the first states to ban child transition. And then the ACLU sued them. And in the first hearing, the Attorney General of Alabama won. So this is working its way through the circuit courts and will probably end up in the Supreme Court, which is where these things need to go to. And we'll see what happens. But there's also an election coming this year. So hopefully Trump gets in. Because, of course, if we have 4 more years of Biden, he's just going to double down on everything and try to make more of this happen. And Trump has already stated on his first day in office, he's going to do whatever he can from the executive branch to stop child transition.
And in 24 states, we've seen legislation pass, right, Chris? In the past year, year and a half, we've seen legislation banning the child transition, protecting women in their sports, right, in their locker rooms, female, the privacy. So we are seeing great advancements. And I just say to every parent that's listening, every person, get off the comfy couch and get involved here, because we need all of your help and support to, you know, really breathe courage into representatives to take up this issue. It's incredibly important. In closing, I have to say, you know, when people talk about feminism, I think it's fairly obvious that feminism spectacularly failed if we have young girls who don't want to grow up to be women. And when I heard Chloe first speak about her regret from her mastectomy and that she hopes to be able to have children someday, and she knows she won't be able to breastfeed them, there was not a dry eye in the entire room. It was the first time she'd ever spoken about her experience in that way. And, you know, at 13, 15 years old, I didn't know that I wanted to have 4 kids. I had no idea that I would breastfeed all of them. And it was a beautiful relationship that I got to have with my babies and feeding them from my body. How amazing. And so the idea that any of these girls can make any of these decisions, you know, with a sound mind and clear conscience at the age of 13 about the rest of their lives is just craziness. Every parent knows this. Do you have something you want to add, Chris?
Yeah, on that point, in the WPATH files, there's actually a doctor from British Columbia, where I'm from, admitting on video that these children cannot give consent, admitting that the parents don't even understand it, that they'll have a meeting, and then the next time they talk, the parents have no idea about any of this. And the doctor makes a comment about how these children are growing up and they're getting into their 20s, and now they can't have kids. And he makes this comment like, oh yeah, you know, the dog's not doing it for you, is it? As though having a pet dog could be a replacement for having a child. These people are inhuman. You want to add to that, Mia?
Well, yeah, this comes on the back of, so it's a terrible conversation where, first of all, he says, he's talking about how difficult it is to talk about this issue with these young kids. And he's like, because we're trying to explain things to kids who haven't even had high school biology yet. They just don't understand. And then he says, it's good in theory to talk to a 13-year-old about fertility preservation, but I know I'm talking to a blank wall. And then he says, they'll be like, ooh, baby's gross, which, Tiffany, like, maybe you weren't as extreme as I was, but when I was 13, 14, when I was a teenager, I didn't just not know whether I wanted kids or not. I was absolutely sure that I would never want kids. It was completely impossible to me that I would ever want to have children. All the way to my mid-20s, I definitely would never have considered having children. And then I hit 30 and baby fever hit and I needed to have a baby right away. I had 3 children. I was a breastfeeding, co-sleeping, stay-at-home mother, like an earth mother, you know, people change. Right. And the way that they talk about these young people in that WPATH session, and then he says himself, there's regret. And I don't think that surprises any of us, because I see these young people coming back in their 20s and they say, oh, I've met someone, I want to settle down. And I say to them, oh, the dog's not doing it for you anymore, is it? The callousness of it.
So he says that, but then he goes ahead and sterilizes and cuts off their breasts anyway.
Well, I just want to thank both of you for coming on and speaking about this issue and kind of giving us an inside look at why this information is important and why it's so important that we as parents keep talking to other parents about this issue, keep talking to other Americans or Canadians about this issue. We are seeing change happen. I've been incredibly proud and lucky to have met Chris and to become friends and to be able to work all over North America with him. Mia, so amazing to meet you. And thank you for getting involved and seeing an issue that you knew you needed to be a part of and making this amazing change happen. It really truly is that it is true that never doubt that one person can make a difference. Never doubt, if you're listening to this, that you say, oh, what am I? You know, I just live in XYZ place. And maybe, you know, what difference am I going to make? You can make a huge difference, because I think the three of us come from backgrounds where we never would have imagined, right, as parents.
I was just going to say, look at the three of us. Who are we?
Yeah.
We're all nobody. Yeah. Just parents who were concerned, who took this on themselves. And Mia's changing the world. Tiffany, you're changing the world. You're changing America. Most important parental rights group in the world. I'm doing my crazy thing out on the street, and hopefully it's having an impact. But yes, one person can do a lot when they put their minds.
One person can. And so Mia, in closing, I'm going to let you close this out for a minute. For parents that are struggling with this issue in some way, if they have a child that perhaps is struggling, they know someone, right, maybe someone in their family, what's the best advice that you can give them as far as where to go for the correct information right now, and then maybe just some mom advice about, you know, how to parent some of these issues?
Where to go? It depends what your issue is. I love GenSpect. I think it's a wonderful organization. If you're looking for, if you've got a child or you know someone, a young person who has got sucked into this, GenSpect is sort of the antidote to WPATH. That's the way I see them. They offer the non-medicalized approach to dealing with this whole gender madness. And so I would always direct people in that direction if they have somebody in their life that is struggling and they're concerned about them. I think in general advice would be always don't be afraid of speaking the truth. To everywhere I go, I talk about this with my hairdresser, in an Uber, everywhere that I go. And normal people agree with me. I've never had anybody not agree with me. So never be afraid of speaking the truth. And for your own children, I have a rather odd tip. So I had to talk to my own children about this, because I had to know that they were protected if they were going through the school system. And we just happened upon J.K. Rowling's The Ichabod, this gorgeous, gorgeous fairy tales book. And when I read it to my children, I realized what a gorgeous message it is for teaching them how a lie can permeate society and good people will go along with it, either because they are too afraid not to, or they fell for it, they're gullible and they believe it. And that always the truth will win eventually, as I don't want to give away the story, but the good guys win eventually. But it teaches them how something, you know, whenever we're talking about gender, when the kids were younger, be like, oh, but it's just like the Ichabod, when everybody believed in the Ichabod and they went along with it. They're not bad people for going along with it, but they just don't really understand. And it's a gorgeous story for grounding your kids and helping them make sense of this lie that has spread throughout our society in a fun, cool, exciting way for them.
I think that's wonderful advice. It's really creative advice in ways to be able to talk to your child about the broader issue of truth and social contagion in general. So thank you for that. I love that we're also closing. We start with J.K. Rowling, we end with J.K. too. So I think it's wonderful advice. Thank you for that. Paradox Institute is another organization. They've got some really great graphics. If you have someone that's asking you questions about all of this, go to Paradox Institute. They have some great things that you can share as well. Thank you both for coming on. I hope for our listeners, this has been informative for you. Follow Mia. She's at Cry Mia a River. Cry me, right? Did I get that right? I love that.
Cry Mia River, but Mia is M-I-A, but an underscore Cry Mia
Wonderful.
River.
Wonderful. On Twitter, and you can always follow Chris, Billboard Chris. Share the information that they share, and thank you both for being so incredibly brave and helping us to protect kids.
Thank you, Tiffany.
Thank you so much.